Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, welcome to New Books in German Studies, a channel in the New Books Network of podcasts. I am Michael O'Sullivan of Marist College, one of the co-hosts of this podcast. Today, we are very lucky to have Dr. Philip Stetzel as a guest. He is assistant professor of history at Duquesne University. Today, we will discuss his book entitled History After Hitler, A Transatlantic Enterprise. The book appeared with University of Pennsylvania Press in 2019. Hello, Philip. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So to start, I was wondering if you could discuss how your interests in the field of German studies first started, and maybe you could share a little bit of your professional biography with the audience. This is kind of a traditional first question for New Books interviews.
Sure. I think apart from my chemist father, who nevertheless had and has a very strong interest in history, I think I need to credit my history high school teacher, who was very good. I had him in my last 3 years of high school, and he emphasized early on that history was not about memorizing dates and names, but it was about interpretation and analyzing sources and making evidence-based claims. And so I think I got an early start by somebody who knew how to teach history well. By the time I finished high school in the late 1990s, there were also a few public debates about historical topics that captured my attention. There was one in Austria, where my family's originally from, about Austrofascism and how to evaluate Chancellor Dollfuss. That really got my attention. There was the Goldhagen debate, of course, in 1996, and the debate about the Wehrmacht exhibition, which I found very interesting just because it revealed that things that historians had known for decades were not communicated to a broad audience, and then caught the audience, a broader audience, by surprise. And so I think all these things together, what I found particularly interesting was sort of this intersection of history writing and politics, and how those two are connected. And that's why I decided to attend the University of Munich and study history.
Great. Thanks, Philip. And to follow up, I would also ask you could share with our audience the circumstances that led you to research and write this particular book. And Philip, you and I met when we were in graduate school, so I know that you have had a transnational intellectual journey of your own, and it seems to have some parallels with your chosen research topic. So I was wondering if you were able to talk a little bit about how your own life experiences have intersected with this book project.
I think initially my transatlantic topic was a way for me to apply for a Fulbright. I realized at some point that I, you know, really wanted to study abroad, and my English was better than my French, so had to be either the US or the UK. And I decided to propose a project on the transatlantic dimension of the Fischer controversy of the 1960s. And I ended up getting the Fulbright, and I ended up working with Volker Berghahn at Columbia University during my Fulbright year, and which was a wonderful experience, thanks to Volker. And I realized, as I was working on this relatively small topic of the transatlantic dimension of the Fischer controversy, that my assumptions on the German-American academic interactions after World War II had been very simplistic. I had assumed that there were a few, after World War II, a few good Germans, a few critical German historians who were up in the battle against the many bad, meaning apologists and nationalist Germans, and that they were helped, the very few good Germans, by Americans. And this dichotomy, I realized, was much too simplistic. And I realized that it might be a worthwhile thing to do to really study the entire post-war period of German-American academic relations, or relations between those historians who study Germany. And after I was back in Germany following my MA at Columbia, because that PhD program didn't quite work out for me, I reapplied to the United States, and I had met Konrad Jarosch, who ended up becoming my dissertation advisor. I'd met him before, and I had a good impression, which then was confirmed once I got to Chapel Hill. And so I think ultimately ended up with really the ideal person to advise this project. And I must confess that I had a moment or two where I was wondering if it was a good idea to write about a topic in which one's advisor had played such a prominent role, at least for half the period that I that I studied. And unfortunately, my not that I had any sort of fears, but sort of my thoughts proved to be unfounded, because Konrad, you know, was always giving me sort of the intellectual freedom that I wanted and I needed. And while he certainly, and I'm sure you know this from your own experience, while he certainly didn't hesitate to tell you very clearly when he disagreed with what you said, ultimately he also made it clear that, you know, my dissertation was my dissertation. And I don't think there's a better compliment to pay one's advisor than saying, if I had to do another dissertation, I would do it with him again. I don't know if he would advise me again, but at least I certainly had a good experience. So I guess that's sort of how I ended up with this topic.
Great. Thanks so much for sharing all that. And it brings back some memories of my own Chapel Hill days as well. So at this point, I think maybe we can jump into some of the contents of this book, which I really enjoyed reading. And I particularly liked the way in which you opened the book. And so you open the book with two statements by two different German historians, Gerhard Ritter on the one hand, and Hans-Ulrich Wehler on the other hand. Now, those of us who went to graduate school to specialize in modern German history have definitely heard of both of them. But they also play a central role in this book. So I was wondering if you could describe these men, and first describe their importance to the German historical profession, but then also explain why they're so significant to the book, and why their two kind of professional biographies sort of frame the book in many ways.
Yeah, Gerhard Ritter was certainly immediately after World War II one of the most influential players in the German discipline. He's first chairman of the German Historical Association after World War II, and had a lot of students at the University of Freiburg. So his institutional importance is certainly hard to overestimate. I think he might have even had more of an influence on the field had he not been such a difficult person. This is something that comes out very clearly in the correspondence that I found in the Bundesarchiv in Koblenz, that, you know, he was certainly not an easy person to work with. And I think that's when it came to the Institute for Zeitgeschichte, for example, I mean, he didn't have a more significant role there because certain people just didn't want to work with him. But he's important for the book because he is a prime example of the defensive post-war nationalist historiography. Those German historians who looked at emigre historians, but also foreign historians more generally, and assumed and argued that those historians lacked empathy and understanding when writing German history, and that ultimately those historians could not produce reliable, sober and objective, as Ritter put it once, works on German history. And so this defensive nationalist post-war West German attitude is one that, you know, was unfortunately quite widespread, and Ritter symbolizes that. Wähler, on the other hand, Hans-Ulrich Wähler, I think if I had to name one historian who had the most profound impact on the discipline after 1945, I would actually say that's Hans-Ulrich Wähler. And I don't mean to say that his, you know, he's the quote unquote better historian than all the others, because that's, I think, that would be a silly statement. But when you sort of take his enormous scholarly output, you know, the many books he wrote and articles he wrote, and you combine that with the many projects he launched while he was a professor at the University of Bielefeld, book series, founding a journal, being involved in many enterprises, and being also a polemicist and generating a lot of debates among his colleagues. And so that really had a profound impact on the field, because as much as you disliked Wähler in the 1970s, you could not ignore what he was saying. You had to engage with him. And I think that made him so influential ultimately in the field. That's his significance in general. Now, as far as my book is concerned, Wähler is also very, very much an example of a generation of West German historians who came of age academically right after World War II and who experienced the United States early on, both the country and its academic discipline, and who developed very different attitudes toward the United States and toward the writings of American historians than the Gerhard Ritter generation. So, you know, contrasting Ritter and Wähler just gets really at us at this crucial shift that occurs in the post-war years, moving from a nationalist defensive to an open and international, if you will, attitude. This is not to say, just to make this clear, that, you know, I'm writing here some sort of teleological success story that, you know, the West Germans arriving on the long way west, to quote Heinrich August Winkler. That's certainly not what I'm suggesting here. But it's one strain in the entire book that is very prominent, this shift among West German historians. But as I also discuss in History After Hitler, there are many other contradicting developments. There are other developments that occur around the same time that really complicate this picture of the German-American scholarly community.
Great, Philip. Thank you. And if I could then take us into the first chapter of your book, and that's kind of putting us in the era of Ritter more than it is the era of Wähler. But in the first chapter, you had this line that I thought you put really well. And you say that that scholars came to the conclusion after 1945 that German history did not just belong to Germans anymore. And this sparked the first period of transatlantic exchange in the era of Gerhard Ritter. And one of your original contributions in the book is to point out that contact with American scholars started well before the generation of Wähler. So I was wondering, can you summarize this early relationship between the so-called traditionalist historians in Germany of the 1950s and the academic establishment in the United States across the Atlantic?
Yeah, I mean, these relations that occurred right after World War II could take on different forms. Sometimes they were renewals of earlier relationships, of earlier connections. Certainly the case for Gerhard Ritter. It also allowed, and this was one, I think, particularly interesting example of transatlantic cooperations that one doesn't often think of. It allowed Ritter to connect with deeply conservative Protestant American historians. There was the Archiv für Reformationsgeschichte, Archive for Reformation Research, was launched or relaunched after World War II as a transatlantic undertaking. And Ritter was able to connect with Germanophile American historians who he was ideologically very close with. He had a lot in common with. And I think we forget sometimes how deeply conservative and WASPy the American historical profession was until at least the end of World War II. And these historians that Ritter then cooperated with they were unhappy about the fact that now, after World War II, there were Catholics, Jews, African-Americans entering the profession in greater numbers. So I think this is one example of a transatlantic relationship that doesn't look so good, but that nevertheless was also part of this broader community. So that's the case of Ritter. Sometimes German historians also reached out to American colleagues or to American institutions in hope of material support. So for example, when the Institute for European History in Mainz was established after World War II, one of their directors, Martin Göring, no relation to Hermann, of course, he wrote to the American Historical Association and said, you know, would you please help us with some funds for the establishment of a library at our new institute? And he was justifying the request with the fact that now West German and American historians were engaged defending the West in the emerging Cold War. So this Cold War situation really allowed for the formation of maybe unexpected ties across the Atlantic. And I think it also sort of shows that there's sort of a connection between or parallel between the academic development that I detail in my book with the broader political development, the fact that, you know, the Federal Republic benefits from the intensifying Cold War and is reintegrated into the international community much faster because West Germany, due to its location, becomes a crucial ally for the United States in the Cold War. And so this also, and that's, I think, the last point I would like to make here, this Cold War situation also and the increased American interest in Germany, in German history, as well as in contemporary Germany, then led to more resources being made available for faculty exchanges, for student exchanges. And this is what gets Fritz Fischer to the United States for the first time in the early 1950s, when he spent several months touring, I think, 15 or 16 different American universities across the country, East Coast, West Coast, Midwest, South, and he meets, you know, many, many colleagues at these various institutions, not just in history, but also in the social sciences. So all of these developments took place, you know, as you mentioned at the outset, very, very early on and well before the Bielefelder sort of entered the stage as important historians of their own.
All right, Philip, great. And so if the first chapter of your book really looks at the perspective of West German historians and the transatlantic relationship from their perspective, your second chapter introduces the post-war situation for historians in the United States. And of particular importance here, it discusses the wide influence of a cohort of émigré historians who fled Nazism and started academic careers in their adopted homeland. So I have some personal stories here, and I'm sure many people in the field of German history do. But certainly one of the great experiences of my undergraduate years in Buffalo, New York, was when I interviewed Georg and Wilma Iggers about their lives as part of a senior project. And Iggers actually also at the University of Buffalo taught my late father in graduate school. He taught him, had him for a couple of classes there. And Iggers is just one of many whose lives are described in this chapter of the monograph. So with so many interesting figures to choose from that you at least touch on in this chapter, which of these well-known figures did you most enjoy researching for this book?
Well, there are a few, and actually Georg Iggers is also somebody I would include. I first got in touch with him when I was doing research for my master's thesis, and he was very supportive early on, incredibly kind and nice to me as a young student. And really, I mean, I was sort of surprised of being sort of really treated like a colleague by him already then, when I didn't even have my master's degree. And I, in between my year at Columbia and moving to Chapel Hill, I was, as I said earlier, I spent a year in Germany where I started my PhD at an institution where things didn't quite work out, even though I also had a good advisor there. And that was in Bremen, which was close to Göttingen, where Iggers and Wilma Iggers lived part of the year. And so I visited them there and certainly have very fond memories of an evening with both of them, talking about history, but also a little bit literature, because of course that was the specialty of Wilma Iggers. I would also mention George Mossy, whose papers show what a generous and supportive mentor he was. I mean, he really, not just his own students for whom he worked sort of tirelessly, but there are also many, many other historians going through his papers that received advice, letters of recommendation from him on a regular basis. So it's clear looking at the Mossy papers why he's so revered by his former students and by many other people in the field. The last person I would like to mention is Peter Gay, who often is sort of, you know, contrasted with the conciliatory and diplomatic and, you know, charming Fritz Stern. And so Gay is sort of seen as this more combative and you know, slightly bitter person. And I have to say, I encountered Peter Gay as a really lovely, lovely man who... it's also, I think, that his memoir, My German Question, of all the emigre historians who wrote their memoirs, I mean, his is by far the most moving, and I think also the most insightful in the, you know, when it comes to the question of the pain that Nazi persecution of German Jews caused. And I had a very memorable lunch with him once, which coincided with my birthday, which was sort of a wonderful birthday present, because a friend of mine knew Peter Gay from the New York Public Library, where Peter Gay was director at an institute. And so he organized for me to meet Peter Gay, and I, you know, was working on my dissertation and asked him questions. And so that's also certainly one of my highlights of my research.
Yeah, what a privilege it must have been to have contact with some of these figures who, for many of us, we know who they are, but we've never met them or don't have as strong a sense of them as people. Although a lot of them have written memoirs, and the Peter Gay one is a particularly good one. I agree with that.
If I may just add, this is something that beyond the emigres, I mean, I conducted also interviews with other historians, with both German and American, and I really have to say that, you know, I wasn't aware, of course, before I did it, but it gave me very different but very interesting insight into the, you know, how our discipline works, talking to these people, many of whom were remarkably open toward me about both, you know, their successes, but also what they considered lack of success or lack of recognition. And, you know, of course, when you, as a graduate student, you talk to somebody who is a full professor at a Research One University, and that person tells you that he feels not properly recognized, you sort of think, well, this is a little odd, but you know, what I'm trying to say here is it taught me a lot about, you know, some of our senior colleagues.
Sure, sure, sure. And I think it sounds like it had to be part of what made this such a fulfilling project to undertake, I would imagine. So yeah, if I could bring us back to the emigre historians, and I guess this also involves the West German historians too, but the book really sheds some light on tension that seems to have existed between these very famous emigre historians and their West German counterparts. And at one point, you analyze how many German academics assumed that resentment clouded the judgment of emigre historians to the point that their objectivity couldn't be trusted. And furthermore, you share your own interpretation at one point about why the ideas of Fritz Stern and George Mosse were not engaged by German historians, even though in some ways they established their own sort of Sonderweg thesis, at least from an intellectual history perspective, long before the Bielefeld school of the 1970s. So I just wanted to give you the opportunity to discuss maybe some of these transatlantic strains as they existed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, when it came to the notion of emigre resentment, this is clearly something that tells us a lot about the West Germans. It tells us nothing about emigres themselves, because the notion of emigre resentment was a paranoid obsession of some German historians. Gerhard Ritter, again, would be one of the prime examples, because the reality was that emigre historians, both of the first generation, so those who already were historians when they were forced out of Nazi Germany, and the second generation emigres who became historians in the United States, they were, you know, emigrated as children or teenagers. Both of these generations, you see a broad variety of opinions on German history. So you have, on the one hand, of course, you know, Fritz Stern's, George Mossy's, you know, critical examinations of German cultural intellectual traditions. But at the same time, you have somebody like Klaus Epstein, who was a much more, you know, I would consider him sort of a moderate conservative historian who certainly had a lot of sympathy for many aspects of German history. And when, for example, William Shirer published his simplistic The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, the most critical, really, really devastating review that came out was by Klaus Epstein, who found the book deeply offensive. Clemens von Klemperer, another emigre of the second generation, comes to mind, who had very different ideas of German history than Stern and Mosse, and actually wrote a very critical review of Mosse's Crisis of German Ideology. Joachim Remarque is a lesser-known German emigre, a specialist on World War I, who was an outspoken critic of Fritz Fischer. So this notion of emigre resentment, again, tells us more something about the Germans, some German historians after World War II, than about the emigres. As far as the second question, or the connected question, is concerned, why the Bielefeld School, why the German social historians didn't really engage the books, the ideas of Fritz Stern and George Mossy, I have a different explanation than Stephen Asheim has advanced, who, you know, has been very critical of the Bielefeld School for not paying attention to those intellectual and cultural histories. I would say that if you were a German historian of the generation of Wähler and Kocka, you grew up academically in a German historical profession where the history of ideas, intellectual history, lacked the critical edge that it had in the United States. And so the notion, the assumption that intellectual history was, you know, heuristically not too useful in the German context of the 1950s and early 1960s was not unfounded, in my opinion. One also, I think, needs to keep in mind that Wähler and Kocka belong to generations, to a generation of historians who, again, came of age academically when the disciplines began to pay much more attention to the social sciences, not just in West Germany, but also in the United States. You know, their contemporaries were much more interested in socioeconomic approaches in the social sciences than their predecessors in the United States. So I think there's a generational explanation that also comes into play here. And so while it's certainly, and I point this out as you mentioned in my book, while it's, I think, somewhat surprising that Stern and Mosse were not received more, that these books were not received more intensively by the German colleagues. I think that is the explanation I would venture. And, you know, other German historians, other West German historians, they were likely, like, you know, Gerhard Ritter certainly would have been likely to ignore a study that critically looked at the German Bildungsbürgertum. So I think, you know, looking at the different forces, the different groups of people who were active in the West German discipline at the time, I think that explains why those books really didn't get the attention that they certainly deserved.
Great. And then you go on in the book to a very crucial section of the book, and that's where you discuss the formative experiences that the next generation of German historians enjoyed in the United States. And so some of the figures you've already mentioned by name, such as Fritz Fischer, Hans-Ulrich Wähler, Jürgen Kocka, these types of people, they recall their time abroad as very formative for the methodological innovations they would later introduce in Germany. So could you offer our listeners an overview of some of their memories from their time abroad and how those memories were impactful?
Yeah, I would think that when, you know, experience you make as a student in a foreign country are likely to be more formative than experience you have when you go to a country as an established scholar. So I think that, I think, is one reason why the years abroad as students, why these were particularly important for the younger German historians. So Wieler, for example, was one of the first or second generation, but he was one of the first or second year of German Fulbright students to come to the United States. And he was at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, and experienced, just like Volker Berghahn, who did a master's degree at UNC Chapel Hill in the in 1961, what they experienced was really a combination of a more open, less hierarchical compared to Germany, academic culture. First, secondly, different curricula. The fact that, you know, rather than in Germany, where the overwhelming majority of German historians, they taught exclusively German history, and if they, you know, were, if they were sort of exceptional, they would also teach a little bit on France or maybe England. But there was not sort of the broad offering that you would get in an American history department. And I think also as a result of the generally very different curricula, those young Germans were able to take courses in other disciplines that they would not have been able to take as German students as easily. The last factor that certainly also was important was the hospitality they experienced off campus. Wieler talks about in an interview volume that came out on the occasion of his 75th birthday. He talks about his host family in Athens, Ohio, that was so nice to him that he ultimately regarded them as second parents. Klaus Schwabe, a diplomatic historian who is in my book, he said, you know, I was especially impressed by the friendly attitude that I encountered among German emigres who were teaching at the university where I was a student in the 1950s. So I think all these things taken together really made such a deep impact on the Germans, who then often came back as postdocs and then later in their careers had visiting professorships or did other exchanges. And it really sort of was the beginning of a lifelong connection to both the United States as a country, but also American academia. Now, regarding the methodological innovations, I think that the familiarity with historiography in the United States, also with, in some cases, American social sciences, was important for the Germans, but did not directly lead to them using those methods in a German context. That is one of my arguments about the Bielefeld School. They often, Wieler and Kocka often sort of portrayed themselves as sort of an Americanized, as pursuing an Americanized form of historiography. And that really wasn't the case. I mean, if you look at the actual elements that constitute historical social sciences, historische Sozialwissenschaft, I mean, they are German. They're not American. But regardless, what's certainly the case for all these people was that their close contacts with U.S. academia, that they persisted throughout their careers. And also that generation was not really susceptible to the sometimes, you know, rather crude anti-Americanism that you see among, that you saw among the 68ers at the time of the Vietnam War. So they certainly were critical of, or could be critical of, you know, political developments in the United States, but they never really wavered in their commitment to transatlantic cooperation, both politically, but also academically.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini,
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
All right. And I think at this point, it's a good moment for me to maybe ask you to speak about what I think is one of your central contributions in the book. And your book challenges what I think is the traditional narrative about how exposure to the United States either modernized or westernized or Americanized. You spell out and flesh out the meaning of these terms in the book. But so how exposure to the United States modernized, westernized, and Americanized the historical profession in Germany. So how does your book offer a fresh viewpoint on this topic?
I think it does so by saying that, yes, it's certainly true that West German historians became Western in a very general sense of, you know, greater openness toward other quote-unquote Western countries, such as the United States, such as Great Britain or France. But, you know, when it comes to the Westernization, I would really leave it at that. You know, the modernization, I mean, modern is really a, I think, problematic category when you talk about the development of academic disciplines, because, you know, what you consider a modern approach, a modern methodology, is, of course, really a subjective question. And you see recurrence of arguments in debates between political and social historians, and then the very same arguments are made a couple decades later between social and cultural historians. And it's always that, you know, the new movement will come and say that the movement they're trying to distance themselves from, now that these historians are narrow and traditional and old-fashioned. The historians who are called that, they will respond that that new movement, you know, is sort of fashionable, but really doesn't really contribute much. So, I mean, the developments, the arguments that are exchanged in these debates are really almost interchangeable. And so what I would say with regard to the Americanization, I think that is, really a key point, I think, in the book, is that you can see Americanization of West German historians at best in the sense of a selective appropriation of trends in the American historical profession, similar to how some cultural historians have talked about the selective appropriation of American popular culture in Germany. But what's interesting, and I think what's fascinating, is that the notion of what American meant in the West German discipline really had changed by the 1970s. Whereas, you know, after World War II, the Gerhard Ritters, and, you know, he was certainly not the only one for whom American views of Germany were unreliable. They couldn't be trusted. American writings on German history were always deemed deficient to some degree. And often you see this in books, saw this in book reviews, that they would say, well, it is a good book. However, as an American historian, scholar such and such lacks insights and so on and so forth. But in the 1970s, American had a positive connotation for Wela and for Kocka. And Wela was always making the claim that the West German historical profession had to catch up with the American historical profession, that West German historians had to look at what American historians were doing and employ those things themselves. And of course, his take on the American profession was also very selective. I mean, he certainly wasn't a fan when once American historians began to turn to Michel Foucault. I mean, he was horrified by that. but again, you know, what it shows is that claiming American connections by the 1970s was an advantage, not a liability. And you know, that gets back to the argument you mentioned earlier in the book, that when German historians realized that German history did not belong to them exclusively anymore, that they could not exclude foreign voices, they often decided then to really co-opt and instrumentalize sometimes those American voices who happened to share their views. And this is not to say that, you know, transatlantic or international scholarly cooperation per se has to be motivated by ulterior motives. It's just to say that, you know, these transatlantic connections didn't always result from internationalist idealism. Sometimes they were also just looking for allies when you were engaged in a domestic debate with German colleagues, and you had some American historians who you'd claim they agreed with you, and that would be useful. And that certainly was useful by the 1970s.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for that explanation. And I thought, so I think to outsiders, the city of Bielefeld might seem to be an odd choice as a place to start an intellectual revolution of sorts in the field of German history. So how did Wehler make the university in the city so important to our field in the 70s, so much so that, you know, his way of approaching history became known as the Bielefeld School, so to speak?
I mean, he was able to, and of course, you know, he didn't do this by himself. I think he was lucky in some ways that he ended up at Bielefeld, which was one of the so-called reform universities established in the late 1960s, because it became clear to the German political establishment that West Germany did not have enough institutions of higher learning. So a number of reform universities, as they were called, were established in the 1960s, and the Bielefeld University of Bielefeld was one of them. And since Wehler received a position at that university early on, he was able to really have influence on the other appointments. So, for example, he was able to, you know, not by himself, but he certainly was played his part in getting Jürgen Kocka as a very young historian. I think he was only 32 when he joined the University of Bielefeld as a full professor. So he was instrumental in getting Kocka to Bielefeld, but also to get Reinhard Koselleck, who of course was pursuing a very different kind of history, compared with Wehler and Kocka. And Wehler talked about this quite openly in his correspondence, both with Theodor Schieder, who was his own Doktorvater, but also with Hans Rosenberg, who was a very important figure for Wehler and for other German historians. Hans Rosenberg, this German emigre who taught first at Brooklyn College and then at UC Berkeley. And Wehler said, you know, we have the chance here, we have the opportunity to assemble a team in Bielefeld of people who do interesting stuff. And that was certainly one reason that he just got to a university that was new, where a lot of positions could be filled with new people. The second important factor here is that the Bielefeld, some of the Bielefeld protagonists, and especially, again, you know, Wehler and Kocka, were not only very productive and stimulating historians who wrote a lot and wrote, you know, many sort of important books, but they also were extremely active otherwise. They launched numerous projects, book series like the Kritische Studien zur Geschichtswissenschaft, which was became a major book series for studies on mostly German history, but not only. More importantly, even the journal Geschichte und Gesellschaft that they launched in 1975. So they also did a lot to establish platforms for themselves. And again, you know, Wehler is on record in letters saying, you know, it's important for us historians, if we want to get our point across, to make sure that we have the ability to do so by having, you know, by having a book series, by having a journal. And so I think he also sort of recognized what you have to do to, you know, position yourself as an influential voice, not just, you know, being a good historian, quote unquote, but also be aware of how you have to get yourself out there and promote yourself. So I think they succeeded on both fronts.
Great. And these so-called Bielefelders, then, they found themselves under attack on multiple fronts in the 1980s. Those who were once the young rebels, they were now the establishment. So who were their expected and unexpected adversaries? And how did Wehler and Kocka try to defend themselves against these adversaries?
What was, I think, so unsettling for the Bielefelders was that by the early 1980s, when they themselves had become part of the establishment, as you say, was that they were attacked from, criticized by fellow progressives or people who considered themselves progressives. They were used to engaging in you know, heated debates with diplomatic historians, with conservative West German historians who didn't like the critical historiography, the kritische Geschichtswissenschaft. Wähler in particular was advocating. But it was new to be attacked from the left. And this is something that started in the 1980s. Historians of everyday life criticized the socioeconomic emphasis on structures by the Bielefeld school that didn't pay attention to individual agency, that didn't pay attention to ordinary people. Women's historians pointed to blind spots when it came to the Bielefeld school in that regard. And last but certainly not least, a group of British historians challenged the Sonderweg paradigm. I think it's really amusing to sort of look at book reviews where, you know, conservative German historian like Thomas Nipperdey reviewing Jeff Ely's and David Blackburn's peculiarities of German history and says, well, these young British historians, they're Marxists. But it's okay because they're good historians, and good historians meant they're historians who agree with me that the Sonderweg paradigm is fundamentally misguided. and so you know, the West German conservatives and Nipperdey was not the only one. They sort of, you know, realized, oh yeah, it seems like we can also do what the Bielefelders do. We use historians outside of Germany who may not agree with what we write, but who are also critical of the Bielefeld school, and that will help us in our engagement with the Bielefeld school. The Bielefelders, you know, kept insisting that American historians were their partners, their allies in their quote-unquote progressive historiographical enterprise. But that was not reflective of reality. I mean, if it's really interesting that those historians Bielefelder had the closest personal connection with, you know, Gerald Feldman insisting that World War I and the immediate aftermath of the war is the big caesura in modern German history. Jim Sheehan, having a much more sympathetic view of German liberalism than Wähler and Kocka. So it was exactly the historians they were closest with who actually had different points of view. And, you know, this is not, I think, surprising. I mean, you know, only that having, you know, cooperating with a historian or having sort of close connections with doesn't mean you have to be in interpretive agreement. But the Bielefelders certainly portrayed themselves to be in agreement with the American historians. And because many other West German historians knew so little about the United States and about American historiography, they bought that argument. And this is something that still, you know, even when I was doing my research, talking to younger German historians today, they were still surprised to hear that ultimately, no, American historians were not on board across the board with the Bielefeld school.
And so far, we've talked about the book from the perspective of sort of post-1945 German history and so on. But it seems to me that this is a book that would be of interest to many people besides just specialists in German studies. So I was wondering if you could speak to some of the ways in which this study has a broader appeal.
I think it could be or should be of interest to anybody who is interested in post-war transatlantic relations, because it connects the history of the academic community to broader political developments. And it shows that in many ways, the trajectory of the academic community runs parallel or in many ways is similar to the broader political relations between the two countries. I think it should be of interest for any historian, regardless of what period or region of the world they study, because it sharpens the awareness of how academic disciplines function and how certain arguments win out over others, and what institutional factors play into that and what political factors play into that. I think it is of interest for people pursuing transnational history because it proposes a non-normative approach to transnational connections. So I think often historians approach transnational connections with the explicit or implicit, at least, assumption that transnationalism is always something positive. It is something, you know, it's a force for the good, so to speak. And, you know, I list some examples in my book of you know, West German historians, you know, after 1945, some of them had really been, had really compromised themselves during the Nazi years, but were found like-minded people on the other side of the Atlantic. So this non-normative approach to transnational connections, I think, is something that has broader appeal. Also, I would say the it can get people or should get people to examine their own assumptions about methodological change and what you consider a modern or a progressive methodology. Because I think there's often unarticulated and unreflected assumptions that go into people writing about methodologies. And finally, the question of empathy and understanding, you know, what one needs, what sort of, you know, what degree of empathy and understanding, you know, Einfühlungsvermögen, as the German word is, that I think I would translate that like that, you know, how important that is for approaching the history of a certain area. So I think these are some ways in which this is of interest, even if you're not particularly interested in historiography or the development of the academic community.
Great. And so I think one of the final episodes in your book deals with an event known as the Historische Streit in the 1980s. And this moment became a very public fight in Germany about its Third Reich history. And it would seem that Germany is in some ways in a similar period right now. You have a far-right populist party, the Alternative for Germany, Alternative for Deutschland, AfD. And it is promoting something of a neo-nationalist narrative of German history. So I was wondering if you could talk about how historians responded in the 1980s to attempts to relativize National Socialist brutality, and then what lessons can be learned as historians decide how to respond to radical right-wing narratives about history today, and not just in Germany, but it's happening in the United States and elsewhere around the world too.
Yeah, I think I would consider the situation in 2019 in Germany different from the one in the 1980s, because the attempt in the 1980s by the Kohl government to focus on a more identifiable history, I would certainly see as less radical than what the AfD wants to do today, because you know, Kohl's you know, politics of the past certainly, I think, you know, has received justified criticism, but it doesn't come close to what the AfD wants to do today. Also, I think in the 1980s, even some of those historians who defended Nolte against some of Jürgen Habermas's criticisms, who were not always accurate, even they recognized that Nolte's positions were just unacceptable, and it brought together historians who otherwise had very different views of National Socialism, like Hans Mommsen and Eberhard Jeckel, who had very different ideas about the role of Nazi ideology and how the Nazi regime functioned, but they were opposed to the apologetic positions of Ernst Nolte. One consequence of the Historiker Streit, and Ulrich Herbert has written a very good article about this, is that it really gave more attention to the history of the Holocaust, which we then saw in the 1990s, and something that, you know, was done much more so than before in Germany. Whereas today, I would say the AfD attempts to promote this neo-nationalist history that's directly tied to other programmatic goals that they have this really radical anti-immigrant stance and many other really horrifying goals that the AfD is pursuing. Now, what can historians do? I mean, I think it's really crucial and for historians to do more, you know, I guess what we call public facing history, to just, you know, make sure that those things that we academic historians find out, that we do a better job communicating that with a broader audience, so that things like, you know, situations like in the 1990s, when results of the Wehrmacht exhibition that in many ways just reflected of what historians had known for 20 years, but had not been able to communicate to a broader audience, that these things don't happen again. And, you know, I just, this summer when I was in Germany, I happened to come across a book by actually a, German historian who does mostly Soviet history, Jan Plumper, who teaches in the United Kingdom, and he wrote a book. It's called Das Neue Wir, which was a sort of a popular but a really well written book on the contributions that immigrants have made to Germany in a historical sweep. And I think we need more of that. I think what's difficult or what I find not just difficult but what I find problematic are resolutions like the one put out by the German Historical Association about a year ago in September of 2018. The German Historical Association issued a resolution condemning, the positions of the AfD and reminding or issuing a plea for a more sensitive language, more mindful of historical developments, but also making a case for a pro-European Union orientation. And I think professional associations shouldn't do that. I mean, I could sign off on any of the points mentioned in that resolution, but I think historians need to do this individually. And when they do it collectively, they just need to organize collectively. But I don't think a professional organization should be issuing these statements, because it feeds exactly into the narrative of the right-wing populists that there's an official take on history, and anybody who doesn't get on board with that is ostracized. And I think we must not provide fodder to these people by falling into that trap.
Great. Well, at this point, Philip, I think we have taken up a lot of your time, and I'd like to end the interview today with our traditional final question at the New Books Network. And I was wondering if you could share with the audience some of your current research projects or research goals.
I have started thinking about and reading for a larger project, which is tentatively titled "The Oppressed of Oppressing the Majority." And what the project wants to do is really study the trajectory of this argument, which, of course, scholars of the United States know very well. Richard Nixon's famous speech about the Stalin majority in 1969. What few people know is that in West Germany, a professor of communications made a very similar argument just a few years later. She called it the spiral of silence, in which conservative Germans found themselves in. And I'm trying to find out, what makes this argument fly and what conditions need to exist that this argument gains momentum. Because right now, of course, and this ties in very, very closely with present concerns, with present debates about the Lügenpresse, the lying press in West Germany, in Germany. And it is supposed to be a contribution to the history of populism by asking, why is this argument, why is it becoming influential? Is it tied to socioeconomic developments? Is it tied to cultural change? What is it that makes this argument so successful? And also, what I'm trying to figure out, why is this argument that there's a majority out there, which of course is a fictional majority, but the majority out there whose voices are supposedly silenced, why is that argument developed by conservatives? Because at face value, I mean, this is a politically neutral argument, but historically you've always seen this as an argument that's articulated by the right. And I'm trying to figure out why that is.
Well, that sounds interesting. Sounds like another foray into the intellectual and political history of transatlantic history as well. And I think if you see the project through to a book, maybe you could come back on New Books in German Studies someday to talk about it as well.
That'd be wonderful.
All right. Well, thanks so much for giving us your time today, Philip. And thanks for being on the show.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much, Mike.
Great. So you have been listening to an episode in New Books in German Studies, a channel in the New Books Network of Podcasts. My name is Michael O'Sullivan, and our guest today was Dr. Philip Stetzel. We discussed his recent book, History After Hitler, A Transatlantic Enterprise, published with the University of Pennsylvania Press in 2019. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And we hope that you will continue to listen.